This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
Good afternoon. This is Keeping the Faith. My name is Don Nolan. I'm filling in for Steve while he's out of town. Welcome to Mother's Day and also to many grads who are going through the ritual of graduation at the University of Illinois. Our topic this afternoon is Poetic Impressions of Illinois. This topic was inspired by a recent and very well-received poetry reading by our guest, Mr. Michael Ledoux. Among his many distinctions, Michael is a politician, a historian slash philosopher, a storyteller, a poet, a whittler, a capnismologist in residence for many years at John's Pipe Shop. He's a fixture here in Champaign and Urmana. Welcome to the program, Michael.
Thank you, Don.
I should say welcome back. You were here once before, about 4 years ago, I think.
Yes, about that.
Many of you know Michael as District 2 Councilman on the Champaign City Council, but perhaps you may not know that Michael has the distinction of being the longest-serving city councilman in the history of either Champaign or Urbana. His sonorous voice has been a fixture in the city council since when? Did you first get on the council?
May of 1985.
My goodness.
Yeah.
Wow. Before we start talking poetry, tell our listeners what on earth a capnismologist is and why a pipe is seen so frequently in your presence.
Well, I didn't coin the word, but thank you for asking.
I found out that you didn't.
Yeah. It's an expert about pipes, someone with expertise.
Smoking in pipes or just pipes?
Pipes generally. Mm-hmm. There is a great deal of lore and history going back, at least 300 years with different materials, the physics of how those materials act under combustion, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
The restoration, of course, is like miniature furniture restoration. I do a great deal of restoration of collectibles. There are many people, not few of whom don't actually smoke, but they do collect pipes.
Mm-hmm.
And there is documentation available in which one can conduct all kinds of arcane study to find out about these things and acquire expertise in behalf of collectors and their interests.
I still have two or three that I collected 30 years ago after I was forced to quit for medical reasons. It's hard to give them up, isn't it?
Well, I could restore them for you, and you could put them in a shadow box.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, you have been writing verse for at least 30 years, and most recently you did this poetry reading on April 26th at Champaign Public Library. This was in celebration of National Poetry Month, and as you put it at that time, you celebrate National Poetry Month every month, but this one in particular was your calling card.
Yeah.
You have read verse across the U.S. and done workshops with the likes of Hetty Jones and Willie Perdomo. You've participated in the Illinois Arts Council-funded Jazz Poetry Project, the U of I Jazz Threads Program, Jazz Vespers, and a Speak Cafe event at Krannert Art Museum, I understand.
That was just one of many. It's just the thing that whoever wrote the library thing decided to write up. But it was about it was honoring Frederick Douglass. I did some research for that and presented a piece about
it. You brought a poem about Frederick Douglass that we'll look at a little later, I hope.
That's true, yeah.
That was a tour de force, I thought. I was there, and
thank you.
Very much appreciate it. A number of people said the same, and that's why you're here today. We're going to talk a little bit about the stories you so beautifully tell and some of the remarkable poetic imagery of local and Illinois people and events this afternoon. And if you would like to call in and talk with Michael as we go through the program, this is a call-in show. Locally, you can call 333-9455. There's also an 800 number if you'd like to use that. It's 1-800-222-9455. So what is your first recollection of interest in poetry? When and how did you acquire an affection for poetic language?
Well, I don't remember a time when I wasn't interested in it. My grandfather was a rhetorician of Greek and Roman rhetoric and oratory and taught. And I was around him when he spoke of eloquence. That was what he did for a living.
Mm-hmm.
And I became interested, of course, in reading. By the time I was three, I think I was reading encyclopedia entries and things. But I got started with, like so many people, Robert Louis Stevenson's Child's Garden of Verses and other juvenilia, and mm-hmm. and worked my way up to...
The Ant and the Bee?
Well, that was even earlier yet. But my mother kept volumes of poetry around from her college experiences, and I just sort of appropriated them. I didn't have to be pushed. I read Edna St. Vincent Millay and Mrs. Browning and Shakespeare's sonnets and Whitman. She had books like that with wonderful marbled covers and yellow dog-eared pages and beautifully indented typeface.
It's all online now.
Yeah, well, it certainly wasn't then, but...
Who have been your most influential poets, would you say?
I can tell you where it started, but everybody's been an influence ever since. But the start was, I was probably a sophomore in high school when I started writing. My English teacher said, why don't we just say you turn in poems and we'll call it an advanced English course? Mm-hmm. And I said, well, that sounds pretty good. I could probably even ditch class and get away with that. Mm-hmm. So... my first influences were Dylan Thomas because of the lavish flavor of his language, the richly flavored and textured language that Thomas used, and the themes that he addressed. And also, at the other end of the stylistic spectrum, the poet of Petersburg, Illinois. I can't think of his name right now.
It happens.
Yes, but Illinois poets and Carl Sandburg, oddly. Mm. But there's a juxtaposition for you. The loquacious plain song of Carl Sandburg
and Dylan
opposite
Thomas's lavishness.
The dense layered lavishness of Dylan Thomas's writing. But those are my earliest influences. And I liked Walter Raleigh, believe it or not, among the Elizabethans. He's not often remembered for his poetry, but it struck a chord with me as a kid.
Mm-hmm. Academicians classify and cross-classify poets in poetry, as you know. You've been at this for 30 years.
Longer, really.
Do you care for classifications? And if so, what genres would you, if a gun was put to your head, put yourself in?
Well, if a gun was put to my head, I would fib and say I like really, really long narrative poems, but that would buy me time. But in truth, I would prefer somewhat enigmatic, mildly puzzling, short verse that emphasizes depth and concision, because those are elements of higher art to me. I don't like prosaic verse. I prefer poetry that advantages itself by taking the full measure of tools available to a poet, different
mm-hmm.
effects.
Mm-hmm. You certainly use compression.
Well, I don't use it. It sort of uses me. I don't do it deliberately.
Mm-hmm.
I am not discursive as a prose writer or as a writer of poetry.
I would say that's
it was
true.
Always very, very difficult for professors to get me to write the number of pages they required. So it had to be good or I wouldn't have graduated. You know, if they said, you got to give me a 10-page paper, I'd struggle and stay up all night and end up with seven.
Right. Well, then we could say you're not in the Walt Whitman, Dylan Thomas, lavish, long poetic tradition?
No. In fact, probably the longest poem I ever wrote is one that you requested me especially to read. Mm. That's 3 pages.
Mm-hmm.
So that for me is long.
I do look forward to that. You are apparently dexterous at this poetry reading. You did a free verse, which was remarkable. What was the title of it?
Oh, it was freestyle. I have a good friend. We discovered each other at Speak Cafe. Mm-hmm. He was a rapper and then a spoken word artist. And yes, there is a distinction. He started out as a rapper and became a spoken word artist. He has since worked on a novel and has written a novel. And he is constantly searching for new ways of expression through poetry. He started out with hip-hop, and he's working his way back. Mm. And I was stunned at some of the things that I showed him that he expressed admiration for. And he says, listen, just because I don't write that way doesn't mean I don't really appreciate it.
Mm.
I mean, I'd show him some of these really short things. For him, 3 pages is just a start.
Oh,
because when you're a spoken word artist and your emphasis is on performance over and above the writing.
Didn't he give you a dare?
A dare?
Wasn't there
He didn't throw down a gauntlet, but we were hanging out together and we were listening to, how cliche, we were listening to John Coltrane. Okay, I admit it. So we're listening to Coltrane, and Coltrane is just flying along with sheets of sound that are, that Miles Davis found interminable, even if nobody else did. And I had a typewriter that I hoped to get some work done on, and I brought it to work with me, and it was on the counter, and it had paper in it. And a professor had come by and typed on there, this typewriter, at the top of a sheet of paper. And I looked at Tone, and I said, all right, dude, you want freestyle, here it goes.
And you did it.
So I jammed out a page of single-space verse in about 8 minutes.
Uh-huh.
And yes, I have 2 witnesses.
Wasn't this in the shop, the pipe shop?
Yeah, this was at the shop.
Mm-hmm.
And while I was doing it, Tone's like, God, you're playing that thing like a piano.
Uh-huh.
And I guess I was. So
it was delightful.
Well, I wish I could do it all the time. I can't tell you where it came from.
Uh-huh.
But
one of the questions I had in mind was you seem to be good at that, obviously. Is that something that you enjoy doing?
I enjoy it a lot, yeah.
Free verse?
It's a real high, really. It's a natural.
Most of it is verbal vomiting.
You think?
Not so much of what people try to do. Yours was a jewel.
Well, I guess that's why I can only do it once, right? I can't give you any assurance I could do that twice.
Mm. Well, you say that you did some work with Hetty Jones in Brooklyn. I think
San Francisco.
Oh, San Francisco.
She
okay.
lives in New York in Greenwich Village.
Didn't she do work with beat poets?
Well, she was a beat poet, and she was married to Leroy Jones.
Oh, right.
When Leroy Jones came back from the Air Force back to Newark, and of course he later became Amira Baraka, and they divorced. But she bore him 2 daughters, one of whom wrote the book Bulletproof Diva, and Hetty wrote How I Became Hetty Jones, as well as a couple of books of poetry and a heck of a lot else. But she helped Allen Ginsberg get published. Of course, she helped her husband get published.
Mm-hmm.
She worked with, is it Diane Prima? Yeah. Anyway, she worked with a lot of the beat poets and as an editor, and they worked on magazines. And
you did a workshop out there with her, as I understand.
Yeah, I met her out there. They were doing workshops. She and 2 other poets were.
Mm-hmm.
One by the name of Lampkin, who's a well-known poet in the Carolinas, who's done some work with Bill Moyers, and a guy by the name of I don't remember the other guy's name, but yeah, I was angry because I was being roped into a workshop, and I've never done a workshop before, and I was really sore. I'm like, this is ridiculous. You're being asked to write something on demand.
Mm-hmm.
Where's the muse? And I was so angry, I wrote something, and it was about the execution of Timothy McVeigh and how Timothy McVeigh so cynically and sinisterly controlled the circumstances of his last months, days, moments on Earth up to reading Invictus by Henley and refusing with superhuman discipline not to close his eyes, and he stared down his accusers and witnesses as the life drained from his eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, of course, since we were doing this workshop thing, we were expected to get up to a podium and share what we'd done. And I got up and read that, and Hetty audibly gasped and invited me to dinner.
It had a kick. You read that.
We had dinner and, you know, talked and had a good time, and we corresponded after that. I've been out of touch with her for a while now, but I understand she still lives in the same apartment she lived in when she was with Amira Baraka in Greenwich Village. She never left. Why would she?
Right.
It's a good spot. Right. As for Willie Perdomo, I came late to a workshop he was conducting. I think it was in Atlanta. I was at a conference in Atlanta. And walked in, and he was announcing the exercise. He says, "Well, I want you all to pretend that you wake up in the middle of the night and your house is on fire." And I said, "Well, Mr. Perdomo, I have an unfair advantage. Perhaps we should try something else. I have actually been awakened in the middle of the night and found my house on fire. And so my ability to speak to that prosaically or otherwise is probably past that of anyone who needed to do an imaginary exercise with it." Well, I did it anyway, so we did that.
I came across a line of him. He's a Puerto Rican diaspora's unofficial poet laureate. How about that? Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Kudos to him. He's known on the East Coast as one of the New Yorican poets. They call themselves the New Yorican poets. So, yeah, that squares with what I recall of him.
So you've got a history degree, as I understand it, right?
I have a couple of them.
Sangamon State, both, or
The first was at I did my undergraduate degree at Sangamon State when it was still really an experimental place, and they did they had a competency based program presided over by some really interesting people who've gone on to do some really interesting things, and they're friends of mine. My oldest and best friend was the department chairman there, and he's done many interesting things and continues to. He was just made the chairman of the board of the Francis Perkins Center in Maine, dedicated to preserving the legacy of the New Deal. Prior to that, he was the director of the Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt Institute at Hyde Park at the Roosevelt Library, where I used to visit him often. So we've remained good friends. And I was the program marshal when I graduated. And then I went to McGill for a year and studied European intellectual history, ran out of money, came back to Illinois and said, "Where should I light?" And I said, "Well, the obvious choice of a place to light is the U of I, and I've
early
been here
80s.
Ever since." Yeah.
Early 80s.
And finished a master's degree here.
Right. Yeah. And your special interest, I'm sure I've got this wrong, Civil War and European Enlightenment? Is that
No,
your,
not at all.
Where,
I had,
read?
In my entire undergraduate and graduate careers, I had one course actually listed as an American history course. The rest was European or philosophy. I took a lot of philosophy courses.
Well, let's start talking about poetry if we can. Kevin Stein is our current poet laureate. He's been in since 2003. What do you think about poet laureates in general?
Well, I think they're a great idea as long as I got a shot at being one.
Yeah.
it's kind of like, you know, what do you think of beauty pageants? Well, if you're attractive and there's something in it, then it must be a good thing. But
He said something that I'd like to get your reaction to before we get you to reading this afternoon. He said, "It struck me that poetic art had not given up its literary ghost. For a fated art supposedly pushing up aesthetic daisies, poetry these days is up and about in the streets, schools, universities, and clubs." I'm wondering if you share his optimistic enthusiasm about public perception and receptivity toward poetry in the public square.
Well, it's indisputable. I think he's right. The thing is, since so much of what our culture is about is massification and commodification, what are the implications for poetic expression of massification and commodification? And hip-hop struggles with that because that's the most commercially successful aspect of poetic expression presently. Does that mean that no one will read Edna St. Vincent Millay, who in her time was a bit of a media star, cult figure, attracted a following of groupies. Mm-hmm. People used to, I mean, men used to just break out in a sweat at her poetry readings. I suppose she was the first person in the modern era to be considered a real spoken word artist in the sense of how she was marketed. So, yes, the phenomenon persists, but it takes on the flavor and complexion of everything else in the culture around it, and responds to that and gives it a voice. Mm-hmm. Whether or not it will endure as lasting good poetry has much to do with how it appears on the printed page.
Right.
And much that is spoken word does not read especially well. And because it needs to take up a certain amount of time and space as an entertainment, concision is rarely a factor. And much of modern poetry, at least in the 20th century, was an experiment with minimalism and concision because that's what painting and music and dance and other forms of expression were doing. Poetry was a reflection of that larger artistic paradigm.
Would you say that the better hip-hop appears better on the page than in sound? Because hip-hop is mostly meant to be heard, right?
Yes.
So how would you evaluate the best poetry in hip-hop?
It's probably not the stuff you hear on the radio. It probably doesn't have very good videos. And if it does, they're short.
I thought I would just, before we get you to read your first poem, just for fun, I know you can do this well. How about some one-sentence short impressions of some of Illinois' more famous poets? So in one sentence or less, what comes to your mind when I say, you've already mentioned, Carl Sandburg?
Would have been a good carpenter.
Edgar Lee Masters.
That's the name I couldn't remember. Edgar Lee Masters was the great Southern Central Illinois poet who wrote about all the people in the graveyard and Abraham Lincoln's Ann Rutledge and all of that. Yeah, he was an influence on me.
Gwendolyn Brooks.
A very nice lady who I could have been friends with. I met her. I introduced her at a reading she gave at the Methodist Church at the U of I, and she commented to the audience that she liked my necktie.
Langston Hughes.
Langston Hughes, certainly a man who understood the value of concision and how concision can promote the impression of depth, whether or not the reality.
And one more. I don't know if you know Archibald MacLeish.
Archibald MacLeish. I was compared with him once in high school.
Oh, my.
But I don't know much about him other than that I love the sonority of his name.
So who else would you rank high in the poetic pantheon of Illinois?
Of Illinois?
Mm-hmm.
Ooh, that's tough. I don't know.
Well, we'll think about it.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you this question because this has often perplexed me, and I sort of had a touch of this. A lot of people move to Champaign-Urbana that know so little about its rich history and are less than motivated to do so. And to a lot of folks, this place is overwhelmingly flat and banal and uninteresting. What would you say as a poet, historian, to someone who sees this region as a place to fly over?
Well, I'd say that prejudice is an expression of the flatness and banality of their own mental landscape.
There you go.
Their paucity of imagination is showing.
Well, I ask this because I was hoping that we would talk about your first, the first poem that we talk about is the story you told about U.S. Grant. So I wonder if you couldn't tell that story again and then read us that poem.
Well, I'd like to tell that story more concisely than I did on the 25th. But Grant, of course, has been maligned by much of the history, because much of the history was presided over by what professionals call the Dunning School of Historiography, a group of historians based in the South who believed that there was a lost cause whose virtues their work should extol. And Grant was the villain in all of that. Mm. They took advantage of his weakness, not really often manifest, for drink, and they allowed the excesses of some of the people around him during his presidency to overshadow his accomplishments. Mm-hmm. While Grant lived, he was considered one of the greatest men in the world. After his presidency, he went on a world tour and went to Japan and all over Europe, all over Asia, and was treated as the greatest military man and mind alive. Mm-hmm. The historian Sir John Keegan, arguably the best military historian of the last 50 years, Keegan opined that of all the generals he had studied from Alexander forward, possibly the best general he studied professionally was Ulysses Grant.
I've heard that.
And it makes sense the more you know about Grant and what he was able to do faced by what he was confronted with. He was also a civil rights pioneer. Grant compelled Congress during his presidency to take the lynchings in the Reconstruction era South seriously and urged that they be litigated against. He was never able to persuade Congress to do that. Grant, in his memoirs, suggested that there were two great regrets he had difficulty living with. One was the assaults on Cold Harbor during the war, and the other was the failure to really, really confront lynchings in the South. Mm-hmm. He wanted the freshly inked amendments to the Constitution at war's end to be taken seriously. And he greatly regretted that his illness and approaching death were closing a life that did not see that happen.
Mm-hmm. He had a significant influence on Lincoln with regard to the Constitution, didn't he? I mean, Lincoln, as I vaguely recollect my dim history, was impressed by Grant's sense of the Constitution, the importance of it.
Well, he would have been. Lincoln ran into trouble in his own time and with some historians since because of his strict reverence for the Constitution and the limits he felt it placed upon him.
Mm-hmm. Well, you told a story about his mustering the first soldiers down in Mattoon.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Illinois Central Railroad tracks are they are almost a trellis for the Mississippi, though the Mississippi predates them, obviously. But the Illinois Central Railroad tracks roughly parallel the Mississippi from here all the way to New Orleans, where you come to the end of the tracks. Vicksburg is on the way. At least Vicksburg was on the way then.
Mm-hmm.
Many people from central Illinois volunteers, were mustered here under Grant's command. And the first point at which they were mustered when Grant assumed a major command was on June 17th in 1861 in, of all places, Mattoon, Illinois, which was an important rail crossroads even then. Mattoon is there because of railroads, railroad town. The Illinois Central built a beautiful railroad station deeply into the railroad cut there that has recently been restored. Wonderful piece of architecture that marks the spot where Ulysses Grant mustered his troops and began his march toward not only victory in the Civil War, but into his own destiny and ultimately the presidency, through a period in our history that was a tumult of economic hardship and business cycles at a time when they were dimly understood, as though they were better understood now, right? But all of this whirlwind of history Grant was central to, from the time he mustered those troops at Mattoon, Illinois, and even into the present. But it started there. This was a man who'd had a successful military career that was cut short by peacetime, by the severe constriction of the military in the wake of the Mexican the war with Mexico,
right,
in which he performed heroically. But when he was not involved in the life of an active soldier, he was a bit lost.
Mm-hmm.
He defined himself in armed conflict,
mm-hmm,
and did so with great success.
Well, let's hear your point.
Well, June 17th, 1861, Mattoon, Illinois. Ulysses Simpson Grant, still slim on hiatus from harness sales, saddle sore perhaps, back from retirement from Army life, stood before the rail cut in Mattoon, Illinois, that still points south to Vicksburg, evenly surveyed his first command as evenly as he prized memory, his last command, in marshaled memoirs of a life. Let us have peace. He mustered here the regiment, 21st Illinois, before whom insurrectionary waters would flow unvexed to the sea one day, lapping, joining two shores washed together as one nation, one great river mimicked by the Illinois Central, whose southbound rails trellised presidential destiny, sown here though not yet grown. Blood brought down by rail and barge from Illinois still binds wet soil, alluvial, in southern Mississippi, mustered first in Mattoon, Illinois. The man who first and best made total war required unconditional surrender first at Donelson, then Vicksburg, Petersburg, and Appomattox, knew the slave and wrong and armed him free, and when a civil leader asked of former soldiers freedom for all unconditionally, let us have peace, profoundly said, that there be no more colored rope-burned corpses heaped upon war dead with unimaginable shame. Resentful sectionalists since defamed his name, and Congress did not formally decry the lynchings that weighed heavier upon him than Cold Harbor. Enfiladed, war-scarred land reforested, receded, cyclone commerce ruined, turned in vast arcs, continental weather darkling, reemergent bright and calm, dreams awakened by a civil war, such that scorched trunks, shelled stubble, seedling conscience, bedded in new shade, stand against the distant prospect green, blanketing the fallen unknowns, shading memory deep and strong. Waking dream, a nation's mental landscape and its arbor, still fed, cleansed, troubled by rain draining unvexed to the sea.
Remarkable.
Thank you.
You also mentioned that Vicksburg was a moving experience for you. I have had the privilege of being there and seeing the unmarked graves.
It made my girlfriend cry.
A lot of people have cried at many, yeah, similar places.
Yeah.
Correct me, my impression was that you felt that if locals knew you were from Illinois, you got special treatment. Is that right?
Yes, and I know people who are involved with the Sons of the Union Veterans of the Civil War who had people who fought there. If you go down there, it's a fascinating place, and I had occasion to meet over the dinner table with the president of the Warren County, Mississippi Historical Association, who was an Annapolis-trained officer, and his wife was from the family of a very, very powerful legislator in the Mississippi legislature, and they're very wealthy people. They lived in the Vick Mansion. Mm-hmm. After which Vicksburg is named.
Mm-hmm,
and I
mm-hmm.
spoke with them a great deal about all of this, but largely because I was from Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
I met others who were members of the Warren County Historical Association and, of course, rangers in the park. And Vicksburg did not celebrate the 4th of July It did not celebrate Independence Day until the Eisenhower administration. Mm-hmm. Feelings ran very, very deep and very bitterly. And when you go to the courthouse, the beautiful, beautiful courthouse in Vicksburg, it is a Civil War museum that was set up, many of its exhibits, during Reconstruction. You know, savaging Sherman and, you know, big exhibits of, you know, shocking early Ku Klux Klan regalia.
And making sure all those cannonballs are preserved in wood.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's all there. It's a fascinating three-dimensional document.
Right.
But if you show up with Illinois license plates, you're treated with respect because they figure you might have some relative buried there. More Illinoisans were buried there than combatants from any other state.
More than
Mississippians or anybody else.
And they're mostly unknown.
They are mostly unknown because the battle took place in July, and the bodies quickly began to decompose in the heat. And they were identified and sorted by regimental badges and uniforms and little else.
And there's just a single monument standing there for the Illinois detachment, isn't that right? Or were there several?
Yes, but the Illinois monument is the largest and most spectacular of all the state monuments at the Vicksburg Military Park.
I was surprised when I saw that. That's true. Let me remind our listeners, we're talking to poet Michael Ledoux, a local fixture here in Champaign-Urbana, for a number of reasons, and we're talking about some poetry that he very successfully presented and was well-received back in April 26th at the Champaign Public Library in a poetry reading. And if you're interested in calling to talk with Michael, you can call 333-9455. There's also an 800 number, 1-800-222-9455. I should mention next week, the topic on Keeping the Faith is the local impact of Pope Francis. The guest host will be Stan Yentjes. Steve will be out of town next week as well. Did you know, by the way, I just discovered when I was thinking about preparing for this program with you, that the Green Mill Cocktail Lounge in Chicago, do you know about that?
Yes.
The supposed birthplace of poetry slams, right?
Yes, I knew that, yeah.
What do you think of poetry slams?
Not much.
I thought you wouldn't.
The thing that happened with them, I mean, they're fun, okay. But it's a little bit like, you know, you're taking something that I have so much reverence for, poetry, and making it like the Gong Show.
A contest.
Which is a bit of a problem for me. Others, obviously, less so. But the chief difficulty I have with it is that it's been years since I read about this, but there was one person most closely associated with that scene. It was largely his inspiration. And for a time in Chicago, he was the star and gained a national reputation. He was urged to publish his stuff and put it in print. And when he did, he quickly fell out of favor because on paper it was not very good. The emperor was shown to have no clothing.
Or have no poems.
When he waved his arms around and made lots of interesting noises and modulated his speech a great deal dramatically, it made for a great performance, but when you put it on the printed page, it made for lousy poetry.
Different kind of entertainment.
Yeah, it's, yeah, so.
Well, you... in your several decades wandering about the streets of Champaign, have gotten to know some interesting characters. I don't know who you would like to talk about first. There's the legendary John Lee Johnston and two or three street people that you've known. Why don't you tell us a little bit about a couple of them and give us a little setup?
Well, I have known, yeah, as you say, when you live on campus and work in the campus area and you're not doing it directly with the university, you encounter a lot of street people. And they get to know you as you get to know them. And I have known a number of them. Several of them are deceased because the lives they lived pretty close to the vest, dealing with the elements and irregular food and bad sleep, living hard. They've died. And they fall through the cracks. We have a society that is the richest, developed society on Earth that has the distinction, not the honorable one, of having the most disparate distribution of assets of any developed nation on the planet, the highest rate of incarceration of any democratic nation, developed nation in the world. We have a number of problems. We have a number of problems, and those problems are made manifest one soul, one person, one body at a time. And I've known some of those people and watched them expire because there is no easy fit for them anywhere. Some of them are people turned out of the prison system, out of very, very structured lives, into a complete chaos of adaptation, trying to find a place to live or be that will sustain them, and they fail to find it for one reason or another.
And then there are these remarkable folks who come out of that kind of environment who succeed admirably, like John Lee Johnson.
Well, I didn't know John had any experience with...
I understand he had a difficult upbringing in his childhood.
Yeah. Well, yeah, he didn't go
That's
to jail
what I'm
or anything
to.
That I...
No.
Oh, okay, yeah.
No.
No, John... Well, John defined himself. He refused to be defined by anyone else. And the definition that he often eloquently and generally, with great dignity, he defined himself as an irreplaceable person. I guess we all are ultimately, but John was my friend. And he's certainly irreplaceable for me.
Which do you want to start with first?
Well, it sounds like you want me to start with that.
Oh, well, either one. Not everybody knows John Lee's been gone for, what, 5-6 years?
It's been longer than that.
Has it?
He died in 2006, I believe. But John was a Champaign City Councilman for 8 years representing District 1. But before that, and long after that, he was active in various changes in the community. He introduced some members of the banking community to the freshly minted Community Reinvestment Act. He tried to organize business opportunities on North First Street for North First Street redevelopment. He was active in health care issues, education issues. You'll remember, as a member of the school board, you probably had to work with John when he brought forth legal action to confront the vestiges of segregation.
And we're largely living with the legacy of that today.
Yes, but John approached me at a business on Neal Street called Raphael's many years ago, dragged me to City Hall, showed me a book of the minutes, said you should run for office. John was one of the people who first urged me to get involved in city government. Mm. But when John became sick with what, you know, John didn't do anything halfway. He didn't do anything small scale. When John got an abdominal tumor, he cultivated the largest abdominal tumor in American medical history. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately for him and the rest of us. And that was removed, and he did not survive the aftermath. But I visited him in the hospital, and I should have gone sooner, and I should have gone more often. Mm. I won't get another chance. No one will. I was quite affected by that and wrote something called Management for John L. Johnson. There were transit type tables to decipher, though I could have walked. The calendar and clock were working, boxed increments arranged like blocks, much smaller silent clicks of quartz clocks not talking, not ticking, never striking, deceptively without finality, routine promised, enacted, prognosis uncertain, protracted, a breaking, impeccable rumor on the latest, last day, promising recovery. We planned our visit for the weekend. We did not wish to interrupt your rest. While you did, we later learned you reached your own weekend. The increments stopped. In this, our present without you, clocks no longer strike. Time does. The managed pain you left is ours to manage now.
Those last lines are quite remarkable given his legacy here locally. Now, you have, you said you've known some down and out folks over the years. You want to tell us a story of a couple of those?
Well, I'm not sure how fair it is to characterize them as down and out. They were underprivileged. They confronted considerable hardship, but
that is a stereotype.
First guy, well, you know, the first guy was one of the most stylish and creative people you'd see on the street in Champaign. There was a fellow who had, he had been a father, he had been a Vietnam veteran, and I don't know what happened. I'm not sure anybody could tell you what happened. But he ended up living on the street. He had some mental health issues, but he had a very active mind with respect to style, and he would show up on the street and go up and down University Avenue and weave through the streets of campus town, very formally curtsying to ladies and speaking about his relationship with the universe and carrying beautifully colored stones and wearing a great, broad, sweeping, dramatic hat, cultivating a natty beard, and often wearing very, very colorful clothing and sashes and beautiful coats and things, even in hot weather. His name was Eugene Hart. And one night, because he liked sleeping outside, it got too cold, and he expired beneath a staircase on Clark Street. And I picked up the paper one morning and read that. And I had known him because he had been a customer and an associate. He had spent time at the shop often, and I'd seen him often on the street and in Scott Park and elsewhere. Many people remember what a colorful presence he was. This is about his demise. The moon covers much, witnesses all on a cold winter night, inescapable light rifling, inquisitive though noncommittal, each interstice and cracking landscape, natural or built, emergent or decayed. Light without obligation flows stolen through scabrous packs of dark ice, light without warmth, a rude guest beneath the ice-flocked flow of weathered stare, beneath which Eugene Hart made hostile, hat pulled low across his eyes in sleep. He did not rise, was missed, then found, cold light his demise, darkness unrelenting his to keep.
Markle, you have a way of punctuating the end of your poems.
Yeah.
That leaves a resonance. Do you want to read another one of those, or we also have a poem that we were talking about doing, and it's on Frederick Douglass, The White City?
Yeah, many people know about Frederick Douglass, but they don't know much about him. Mm-hmm. The name is everywhere. His legacy is only spottily appreciated. Many things he did, one of the last things he did in his life with global repercussions. He was the representative of the Haitian Pavilion at the Great World's Fair, the Columbian Exposition of 1893 in Chicago, on the south side of Chicago. The organizers of that involved, you know, Mr. Palmer of the Palmer House Hotel and the luminaries of Chicago society who were setting up the museums we still enjoy, many of whom lived on Prairie Avenue, which was referred to by young Theodore Dreiser and others as the Fifth Avenue of the West. It was the street to be on in the city that was the place to be if you wanted to be a self-made millionaire. And Chicago wanted to show off to the world. Well, Chicago already had a sizable African-American population. And for some reasons you can guess, the organizers of this World's Fair did not have anything to honor the contributions or participation of African Americans since their liberation after the Civil War. Frederick Douglass and and others got together and formed a committee to address this omission. And it became a matter of great controversy in the African-American community across America how this would be dealt with. A great many felt that the fair should be boycotted. Douglass thought that an opportunity to highlight the accomplishments of African-Americans in the wake of the Civil War, since the Civil War, should be pursued. A number of people agreed with him who since became famous, and they got a toehold on national and international fame because they sided with Douglass. Henry Ossawa Tanner, the great painter. Mm-hmm. Scott Joplin, the pianist and composer. James Weldon Johnson, the poet. These were individuals who sided with Douglass, and they became famous. But there was a day set aside for African Americans called
the. So the debate was boycott or accommodate.
Boycott or accommodate. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Douglass urged that this should be seen as an opportunity and made it one.
Mm-hmm.
But.
That's the theme of his life, really, in many ways.
In many ways, absolutely. And there are historians and polemists who fault him for his accommodationism. Mm-hmm. And it's for them, accommodationism is the A word.
Mm.
You know.
Let's hear your point.
It's called, appropriately, the White City, because that is what the fairgrounds, extensive as they were then called. Glistening white plaster buildings, mostly. Chicago's Prairie Avenue, so straight on street maps, bent in memory's noiseless wind toward undifferentiated wave upon the lake like autumn thistle, with Theodore Dreiser's words, dry on the page in his bloodless absence, selectively recalled in college am-lit courses, like great many storied thunderheads passed dry overhead, dispelled by fear of what they might rain down. Great homes, where Paderewski played, and nascent global industry was captained over crystal and Havanas, loomed judgmentally arrayed, like John Brown's forgetful, reconstructed soldiers, suited dark, parallel to rail lines, seed corn gilded, glinting, girdling festivities in plaster temple castings celebrating Greece, belying caste, housing expectation, and modernity in 1893, the World's Columbian Exposition. Prairie Avenue presided. White as the sepultures across those tracks, denying the African who laid the rails, washed the crystal, would and will not be denied a fact dismissed as untrue. Frederick Douglass came by rail at his behest, addressed the exposition and the world, his hair and beard white as the plaster acropolis between the lake and Prairie Avenue, white as the hecklers he put in their place, well beyond their own purview in a time not yet lived, having not shown its face. It subsequently rained on empty lots through lamplight soft on Prairie Avenue, encumbered more by shades than shadows cast by mansions, structures, family, or enterprise now gone. New enterprises, longer shadows, many storied conceits inhabit Prairie Avenue like condominiums constructed over unmarked graves.
Mm. I take it you've been down Prairie Avenue?
Many, many, many times, all through its gentrification, mm-hmm. from when it was a kind of a dicey abandoned warehouse area with the abandoned Don Levy, the publishing company that did the phone books. Beautiful old 1920s buildings and older.
Mm-hmm.
Markers were the great mansions where these planners of the exposition used to live, part of Lost Chicago, mm-hmm. which has been documented. But that whole area, which only had a few inhabitants when I first started wandering around there, is all gentrified now.
All right. We have just a few minutes left. We're talking with Michael Ledoux, our
local poet and politician and philosopher and historian who recently put on a very impressive poetry reading at the Champaign Public Library, and we're here to talk about some of the poetry that he has written over the years that give you impressions that you may not have encountered before of Illinois. Michael, do you have one fairly short one that you would like to make sure we get in? And if we do, maybe we can do two.
Fairly. To remember all the disadvantaged people who are always with us, always among us, often disappearing. This is about such a disappearance. A Shadow in the Alcove, it's called. It was done in wintertime. Softening snow prints, silting up crevices, blizzard soft, dull as self-absorption, lulls streetscape, more sediment than snowfall. One tiny hooded man bends legs and back compactly in an alcove to conserve himself. In that alcove, sidewalk side, there is no guile, just one small, bewildered man for whom what remains of entitlement is refusal for coffee in warmth. A hand extended pauses on the shaking, narrow shoulder, cold and soaked. This man, calmly unprovoked, declines to move, committed as he is to purpose clung to, even as he sinks in quiet snow. Hours later, that hand preferred points in the darkened alcove on whose pristine floor light startles virgin snow.
Remarkable. And you knew him.
I didn't know him personally, but I tried to get him a cup of coffee. I think he finally accepted. He refused to be taken into a Starbucks and warmed up. Mm-hmm. It was as though he were a devoted sentry.
Mm-hmm.
But he was exercising the only agency, the only volition left to him
right. In
his circumstances.
The last shred of control.
The last shred of dignity, the last shred of control. He would rather have been cold than accept charity.
When are we going to hear you do another poetry reading?
Whenever you like.
I hope it's soon. Right. Michael, thank you very much for being with us. I wish we had more time to get more in. Appreciate it very much that you've been with us today.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me.
We'll have to do it again. We've been talking with Michael Ledoux and his poetry, Poetic Impressions of Illinois. You're on Keeping the Faith. See you again next week. Thank you. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.